Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, July 19th, 2007, and I have so much material to cover tonight. I'm going to try and do a brief summary of each topic so I can get through all of these different topics rather than spend a lot of time on any given one topic. First of all, Japan this past week had not only a typhoon, major typhoon, but also had a major earthquake. Now, when I did my weather work, when I talk about the science of the electrical nature of Earth, part of that science deals with earthquakes and also, of course, typhoons, which are the Pacific name for hurricanes. The reason these storms and earthquakes occurred at this time was because of the new moon passing. Now, you can actually, we've seen this many times before, where earthquakes and major cyclonic ocean storms, hurricanes or typhoons, especially in the Pacific, coincide. And science has not made that connection yet. They still don't understand. And, of course, they're still looking at the ridiculous ploy that somehow typhoons are powered by warm water, by bath water, that somehow they power these immense storms, which is absolutely ridiculous, because simple conservation of energy would tell you that the amount of energy in these storms is in no way, shape, or form related to the amount of energy that you can derive from a small amount of ocean cooling. It's quite the reverse. I always say it's like watching a car go down the road and say someone has never seen a car before, and they see it going down the road, and you ask them, how is this car powered? They say, oh, well, the only thing they can see is some exhaust coming out the exhaust pipe. So they go, it must be that exhaust coming out the exhaust pipe that makes the car go forward. That's the same thing hurricane specialists are doing with hurricanes and typhoons. They see a slight cooling of the water and say that's the source of energy of the typhoon or hurricane. Absolutely ridiculous, because a small, quick, back-of-the-envelope measurement and calculation would show you definitively that that couldn't possibly be the source of energy for these immense, powerful storms. But as with anything you see in modern science, as long as they're getting a paycheck, they'll say anything. But the point here is a couple issues with the earthquake in Japan. The typhoon hit on the 14th, one day after the new moon, and the earthquake hit 2 days after the new moon, what I call the new moon passing. And here's what happens. The moon in the new moon phase is between us and the sun. As it moves away from that position in its orbit, while it's in the new moon position, it's actually blocking the solar wind and buffering Earth from the solar wind that's coming from the sun. And as soon as that moves out of the way, all of a sudden the solar wind comes crashing in, reconnects with Earth, compresses our ionosphere, the magnetosphere of Earth, etc., because the moon is about 250,000 miles away on the nose side of Earth, our imaginary magnetic shield, what they call the bow shock, the region where our magnetic field reaches out and blocks the solar wind. That is only about 30 to 40,000 miles away from Earth. So you can see that there's a vast area of outer space between the moon and that magnetosheath shield of Earth. So when the moon moves out of the way, that solar wind comes pounding in, the electrical currents and the shock that hits the upper atmosphere is transferred down into the Earth, thusly the typhoon and earthquake simultaneously hitting Japan. But now let's look at some of the environmental impacts here. As we all know, the headline was that the largest nuclear power plant on the planet, I don't know if it's the largest, but certainly one of the largest, nuclear power plants ruptured during the earthquake, and radioactive gases, water, spilled out of that reactor. They said about a gallon, and I find it hard to believe that you would have a spill with 1 gallon of water. I saw the picture, and it was very strange reporting because they said that the water leaked into the ocean, and then afterwards they measured the ocean for radioactive byproducts and said they found none and there was no environmental concern. But when I saw the picture, the water was coming out in the form of steam, not liquid water, but steam. So why would they measure the ocean when in fact the liquid water came out in the form of steam? At any rate, this brings up a topic. I'm going to cover a few quick details here. If Earth ever has a major catastrophe from outer space, whether it's an asteroid colliding into Earth or whether it's a big object coming by Earth, of course you have all of the effects described in my books. The Earth changes, that type of thing, and it can go anywhere from a mild situation to a very extreme situation where you have mountain building, the oceans rising up and swallowing the land, and huge tsunami waves, etc., the electrical conditions. But I want to just project something. What if we had even a minor catastrophe, a small asteroid crashes into Earth, or even a relatively small celestial object comes by, you know, moon size or Earth size, somewhere in that region, not one of the giant ones like what we would think of as a Nibiru, but something relatively modest. And the earthquakes that would ensue, what would happen to Earth? And this is a very interesting point. I don't think anybody's really pondered this before. Of course, I think about these things in my own mind. But tonight I want to transfer a little bit of this information to you, the public. Nuclear power plants, chemical plants, petrol plants, that is petroleum processing refineries, biowarfare plants and facilities, none of these are really designed to handle major earthquakes, as we see in Japan, where they would certainly have, you would think, codes that would require them to build to withstand major earthquakes. Now, chemical plants, petroleum processing plants, biowarfare plants, none of these really have serious earthquake protection or foundations. Now, in South America, where earthquakes are more common, a lot of the big buildings actually are built on a giant bowl of cement down at the bottom and can withstand tremendous earthquakes. Some of the larger buildings, that is, not the smaller buildings, but the point is, if and when any of these facilities would rupture, therein lies the problem. Even if you make it through, say, the earthquakes and the flooding and the other damaging effects, then we're going to have a very serious pollution event on this Earth because these facilities would rupture open, their contents spilling out. Can you imagine a biowarfare plant being ruptured and broken with its contents spilling out all over, or a nuclear power plant with the liquids spilling out into the environment? It would poison the Earth for millions of years to come. What is man doing? It's creating a disaster. It's a disaster waiting to happen. And of course, the one thing that will be most difficult to get in any of these times, whether it's mild or severe, whatever, is safe drinking water. So I want to read something here. This brings up another topic. And also during the typhoon, of course, one of the things that is most difficult to come by, fresh drinking water. I want to read this legal notice. It came from this was sent in from a local newspaper, legal notice, this is in the legal notice of the of a newspaper, and I want you to hear what this says. Just in summary, the city did not take its monthly required samples of water, and I want you to hear what they say about this. But note the timing on this. This is absolutely absurd, and somebody in a city office completely incompetent is expecting the public to buy off on this. Okay, monitoring of requirements not met. Important information about your drinking water. Notice this is a legal notice in a newspaper printed by a city that failed to test its water. The city is required, I'm reading right out of the paper now, the city is required by Minnesota rule to test 10 samples of water every month for coliform bacteria. This required sampling was not done for the month of May 2007. I'm going to stop here for just a second to tell you that this notice is being printed on July 14th, 2.5 months after the fact. Okay, so here we go. I'll read again from the newspaper. This required sampling was not done for the month of May 2007. Because we did not monitor or failed to monitor completely during the compliance period, we did not know whether coliform bacteria were present in your drinking water, and we are unable to tell you where your health was at risk during this time. Can you believe this? What does this mean to me? Then they say, this is not an emergency. You do not have to boil your water because the notice is 2.5 months late. They can't tell you if you had coliform bacteria poisoning from city water 2.5 months ago. Isn't that nice? So all I want to tell you is when you go to that city water faucet and you turn the handle, don't expect real clean water to come out because these cities are incompetent and they won't tell you. This notice should have been printed at the very beginning of May, not July 14th. And so anyway, I just want to express, if you don't have your own source of water filter, and I absolutely recommend the gravity feed type, not the type that's inline in your sink, because those will fail. If there's a crack in it, all of the water will go through the crack or the seal because it's under high pressure. So that's why the gravity feed, you pour the water in the top. There's no hoses or electricity or connections. You just pour the water in the top, and it's also portable. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but my goodness, in this world we live in, if you don't have your own source of fresh water, you are crazy. That's all I can tell you. A quick announcement about Prime Numbers. Now, I haven't been talking too much about Prime Numbers lately because of the great number of other topics in the news. I just want to pre-announce a development that I've had in the progress in dealing with prime number issues, and that discovery will come out somewhat in the near future. And it's there are so many secrets locked in the prime numbers, and I'm discovering more and more every time I go back and work with this amazing system. But a new development has come out relative to number theory with prime numbers, and I'm very excited about this. I'm still working out some of the details, so I'm not going to publicly announce the discovery at this point, but I'll just tell you, for all of those out there that interested in the prime numbers, that if you've read the Calculate Primes book and watched the DVD offered on my webpage, then this will interest you because it's it's very neat stuff. I love this theoretical and pure mathematics. That's one of my favorite things in the world, in the universe, and a very exciting new development coming out of the prime number world coming up very soon here. I'll be announcing that. A baby woolly mammoth was discovered in Siberia, and this was some time ago. They're making the announcement public at this time. But isn't it strange that as soon as they discovered this, they walked out in the field, looked at it, and they said, 10,000 years old, possibly 40,000 years old. And I just shake my head. This is when I was in the Latin America at archaeological sites or other things that happen, whether you're dealing with astronomers. They look at Mars and they go, oh, it has oceans, but 2 billion to 4 billion years ago. Where do these people come up with these numbers? Ah, there's got to be a hat somewhere in every government office where scientists are employed. There has to be a hat with numbers on them, and they just pick the number out of the hat. What number did you get? 40,000. Okay, that's what we'll tell the public. What number did you get? 2 billion. Okay, that's what we'll tell the public. You found a bone in the desert? Pull the number out of the hat. 2 million years. Whoa, you got 2 million years out of the hat. I'm serious. Where do these people get these numbers? There's no scientific basis for the ages that these scientists are giving to everything from stars to planets to comets to woolly mammoths to bones found in the desert. It is ridiculous. Anyway, it's a very interesting find, though. This woolly mammoth was a baby and very well preserved. Now, sticking out of the snow when they found it, and apparently they're finding more and more of these woolly mammoths now that we're going through a warming cycle in Earth. Remember the one they found a couple years ago standing on all 4 feet in the Siberian tundra? They went in and dug it out, and they had to get a huge American helicopter in there to lift this thing out of the hole because they had dug all around it, and this thing probably weighs, 10,000 pounds or something, including all the ice, and it was just too big, those big curlicue tusks sticking out of a block of ice. And here's the mammoth standing on all fours. Remember that the mammoths were a tropical, semi-tropical animal. They did not exist up in the tundra in what we call Siberia today. It was much more tropical at the time. And the interesting thing about the one they discovered years ago was that it was standing there. It didn't fall over. It didn't die and fall over and then get covered with snow. It was standing on all 4 feet, the same way it died. Now, the little flowers in its throat, undigested, bugs in its fur, unaffected. So they have this absolute storehouse of ancient material from a long time ago, and many experts actually believe that the woolly mammoth still existed up to 4,000 years ago. That's all. And that the actual beginning of that ice age was around that time. And this is due to, for example, measuring the ice cap on Antarctica, other measurements. So at any rate, very interesting baby woolly mammoth discovered in Siberia. I already mentioned the new moon passing this past week, and I'll be talking shortly about August 12th. And this August 12th, believe me, I think a lot of things are coming up for August 12th, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Russia this past week withdrew from the European Arms Treaty, one that had been in place since 1990 or 91, and these were extremely delicate treaties that were put in place because people realized that you could not have a stable planet and put in at the same time anti-missile defense systems. So the ploy by the United States to put anti-ballistic missile systems in Europe, in the Czech Republic, and other locations in Europe are destabilizing the world. And obviously they're not for terrorism. If you were worried about Iran launching missiles into the United States or Europe, you wouldn't put the anti-missile defense system in Eastern Europe. obviously there's a political move. They're trying to antagonize Russia. And also this past week, more flack out of England regarding the KGB double agent that was murdered in England this past year by poisoning with nuclear materials. But at any rate, there's an argument going back and forth as to whether the West killed the guy or the East killed the guy. And in the game of spy versus spy, believe me, I couldn't even begin to tell you who may have killed this guy. But at any rate, more tensions rising between the East and the West. It looks like we're headed back to about 1952 and the Cold War. The Cold War mentality. But just a quick update on pollution. Here's another. Remember I talked about 3M Corporation pouring for decades and decades the Pollution Control Agency of Minnesota, allowing 3M Corporation to pour the chemical residue from making Teflon into a hole in the ground out in the country east of St. Paul, Minnesota. And at the time, they said, oh, well, they had measured. Everything was hunky-dory, just great. They had identified the pollution, and 3M of its own would clean up the mess. This past week, it was announced that the pollution was far greater than originally stated. Who's paying who? And it's just a huge, amazing mess. Now, there are people that are dying over there because of the chemicals that are in the ground. And this is kind of a powder chemical that carries in a liquid base. Basically, it's a byproduct of making Teflon, that stuff that you put on pans. And I'm sure a lot of people out there have eaten a lot of Teflon as it got scraped off the base of pans over the years. So at any rate, that story will be going, covering in future episodes of this show. But the Pollution Control Agency is once again owned by corporations, paid off, and out of sight, out of mind, I guess is the only term you can use. I remember when I was a young kid, my aunt and uncle and their two daughters both contracted cancer. They lived up in a suburb. Turned out that there was a company pouring creosote down a hole inside their company, and the entire city, this one entire city, everybody was getting cancer. And this is still going on. The year 2007, still allowing corporations to pour chemicals down a hole in the ground out in the countryside. Okay, on to this topic. Oh, one quick thing before I forget. Talk about no news. The scientific world is in the doldrums. For the last week and a half, the top science news story on CNN, giant squid washes up on the shore. Where on earth is all the money going that we pay for science? That's the top science news story. No wonder kids are bored to death with science. Good grief. It just makes me quiver to think of all of the money and resources being wasted on science today, and that's the top science story for a week and a half on major news media. Okay, on to August 12th. Now, this is a big story, and I want to cover this because I'll tell you how this whole story unfolded. I was on a radio show with host Brad Walton on WCCO. It's one of the big Minneapolis stations that after 10 p.m. can crank up its transmitter to 50,000 watts and covers the entire eastern United States, 38 states, all the way down to Mexico and north up to Nova Scotia, anything east of the Rockies. In fact, I had friends in New York one night listening on their AM radio to my show here out of the Twin Cities. So that station gets a lot of airtime, or a lot of really reaches out there, let's put it that way. So anyway, one night I was talking on the air, and the host had asked me to give my interpretation of my what I call my annual predictions. They're not really predictions, but they're statements of electrical conditions in the solar system and what they, some of the convergence electrical alignments, and of particular note in one, what I was saying was August 12th. And I'm not going to go into all of the electrical alignments. I'll be doing that here in the next week or two as August 12th approaches. But I was saying that there is a very big cross solar system alignment of planets, an amazing alignment all the way across from one end of the solar system to the other with the sun in the middle. And so anyway, he took this information to an astrologer friend of his. Now this is going to be very interesting, and most people think of astrology as voodoo science and quackery and people trying to foretell the future, or you know, you read your newspaper zodiacal sign you know, daily prediction or whatever, don't do this today or you will find love today, one of those, you know. But anyway, astrology is used by many people. Ronald Reagan, when he was sick, believe it or not, the country was run for about a year and a half by Nancy Reagan, who was visiting an astrologer. Your country, the United States, was run by Nancy Reagan from an astrologer. And so the point I'm trying to make is that the people running the world, so to speak, the New World Order, the Dick Cheneys, the Bushes, the Skull and Cross or the Skull and Bones Society, those people are extremely superstitious, and they work by way of soothsayers, astrologers, and signs, and very much they live by these. Now, get this: on 9/11, September 11th, 2001, there was a very set astrological, they call them squares. They're alignments and configurations of the planets, moon, stars, etc., relative to Earth. Guess when the next set of squares exactly like that will occur? August 12th, 2007. And when my friend Brad came back to me with this, now understand, we don't believe in astrology, but we know that the people trying to pull these New World Order shenanigans do live by astrology, and that's what's very important. Now, remember that a number of things are happening in August. Congress will be in recess. Member Condoleezza Rice asked for two more months. They just wanted two more months, and everybody was saying, what do you mean two more months to get out of Iraq? What do you need two more months for? The thing is an absolute failure, and this is like a convergence of Republicans and Democrats across the board. They're saying, what do you need two more months for? Well, I got news for you, folks. August 12th is in the next 2 months, and they need an event, but they don't want to pull it on just any date. They have to do it because of their superstition on a very special date, and that date is August 12th, either from the 9th to the 13th. And according to the astrologers that have reviewed this, relative to the configuration of the planets that occurred on September 11th, 2001, August 12th, 2007 holds that same configuration. And they give it a plus or minus a few days. So they actually were talking about August 9th to August 13th. And the reason, once again, I'm telling you this, now some other things, I've talked before about the Queen Watch. Where's the Queen? Well, I had a report come in this past week that the Queen is in the United States right now, and the Pope is on his way. Very interesting, because what I said before is when the Queen leaves England, watch out. She was here earlier in the spring, of course, visiting NASA, of all places, and we're very sure she was visiting her new quarters in the cave systems built in the United States. And remember that England does not have substantial topography to warrant putting cave systems in, So anyway, the Queen's new residence, it appears, is in the cave cities in the United States. Same thing with the Pope. So anyway, once you start to see the convergence, and here's the way we look at these in the industry, in the disinformation industry, as we watch disinformation ploys going on, the release recently of an Al-Qaeda tape to take the heat off of Iraq, that took the headlines of CNN for a couple days. And you see these disinformation ploys going on, you start to see that they're working up towards something. And that something appears to be focused on the dates surrounding August 12th. So more on that, and of course I'll be doing my weather focus on that time frame, because that in fact has the August return current sheet and the cross solar system electrical alignments that could give us some very severe weather during that time. But I will keep you updated on that. This past couple days, a small comet is racing through the solar system. It's not going to affect Earth directly. It's a very unusual little comet called Comet Linear BZ13-2006. And I know astronomers like to turn those letters around and pronounce, you know, change the order of the words in these comet designations. But basically, it's a small comet. It's coming across the solar system, down around about the orbit, I believe it was crossing about the orbit of Mars, and then heading down under the solar system, so to speak. But the interesting thing about this particular little comet was that it was green and red. It had some very interesting chemicals in it. They suspect that the green is from a chemical known as cyanogen and diatomic carbon. That's the scientific estimation of the cause of the greenish color, but they're not too sure why it's red. Now, according to standard science, this is material that's coming off of the comet, and according to my science, this is material coming into the comet. So it's very interesting that these regions of our solar system have some interesting chemicals at this particular time that are being attracted into this comet nucleus. And the red color, my suspicion is that it is sulfur dioxide. That's typically, for example, Comet Schumacher-Levy 9 that hit Jupiter had very white comet tails, water tails, as it approached Jupiter. And as soon as it crossed into the realm of Jupiter, the tails turned to orange. And of course, NASA scientists didn't think much about that because they couldn't explain it. But the reason for the turning of the color of the comet tails, the 21 pieces of Schumacher-Levy 9, the reason they turned color is because they entered the region of Jupiter, which is rich in sulfur dioxide. So it would certainly be very unusual that all of a sudden, as they got there, they started producing sulfur dioxide. What a ridiculous concept, given that they had been in outer space for observed for years and years and years with just water. All of a sudden they get near Jupiter, and all of a sudden they have sulfur dioxide in their tails. Well, that's because the material is drawn into the comet nucleus. Comet Schumacher-Levy 9, there's a whole series of stories revolving around that. And on the same tone, this past week I got some emails. A guy named Zachariah Sitchin was responding to Comet Temple 1, which was the target of that probe that went into the nucleus on July 4th, 2005. Yeah, and that, of course, I was on Coast to Coast AM that very night. And there were two other guests that were on the show that night. One was a Richard Hoagland, and the other one was a guy named Tom Van Flandern, who is a former retired, I believe he's retired now, astronomer from the Naval Observatory. But what Sitchin is saying in his posting on his webpage is that it's very clear that as the probe slammed into the nucleus of Comet Temple 1, that the materials that came out that were measured by the scientists at NASA were the result of organic processes. In other words, something that occurred like with seashells or other organic organism residue that you would find on Earth. So how on Earth could this get into a comet nucleus? In Sitchin's statement, of course, and this is commensurate with what Van Flandern has been saying for many years, that there used to be a planet between Mars and Jupiter, and that historically there are indications coming down to us by way of information, writings, myths, whatever you want to call them, that there used to be a planet and it got totaled out because something hit it, something big from outer space. And so that would possibly give you a clue for why a little chunk of rock out by Mars would have, that is the nucleus of Comet Temple 1, why it would have carbonaceous limestone type minerals in it that would only form in the presence of liquid water. So very interesting. That is something, and when I was on Coast to Coast, we talked about that, and I said that the comet nuclei are a mixture of captured and the residue of smashed planetary and stellar debris. In other words, stars have collided, planets have collided, and when they do, of course, the spray of material goes all over, so it would be difficult to say if that particular chunk of material even was from our own solar system. It could have formed in another solar system, you know, many, you know, light years away, and over the eons of time, flew through outer space and was captured into our own solar system. So hard to say exactly where these objects came from, but it's safe to say that it was part of some larger object at some time, smashed to pieces, and that's one of the little pieces left over from that major celestial collision. By the way, Comet Linear VZ13-2006, excuse me, is visible in the evening sky. If you look up after sunset near the handle of the Big Dipper with binoculars or a small amateur telescope, you should be able to see this. For more details, look on the internet. I'm sure there's many sources. The one source that I saw this on had a map and a reference, a link to an internet map where you can see on a particular night where the comet is, where to look. Spaceweather.com. There are many other links, I'm sure, that have that information. Anyway, look on the internet, do a search, and I'm sure you'll find that. Look for the green comet, or just go to spaceweather.com. They had a very nice set of links there to give you maps and star charts and finder charts, etc. Just a quick mention, and the reason I'm mentioning this on my show, I try and stay away from political issues on this radio show, but because of the news blackout on the following topic, I'm deciding to include this in my show. A lawyer named Tommy Cryer, C-R-Y-E-R, I'm sure many of you have not heard about this because there's been a total news media blackout, from Shreveport, Louisiana, was in court with the IRS. And he challenged the IRS in court to prove that it had basis for taxation of individual incomes based on labor. In other words, working for a living, which many people do out there, the majority of people, in fact. And at long last, the IRS was forced to get on the witness stand and could not produce the law that requires you to either fill out tax forms and file an income tax return. Very interesting. You can find this on the internet. There's a there is a series of videos on YouTube you can go and listen to those. Also, there's a number of web pages which have been covering this. But the major news media, as I said, there's a total 100% blackout. The Department of Justice, who was the attorney staff for the government, for the IRS in this case, refused to comment about the loss of the case. Cryer was acquitted by a jury of his peers. 12 jurors found him not guilty of tax evasion. The tax evasion charges were actually dropped before the court case by the IRS because they knew they couldn't win them, and they went to failure to file, and those were the only two charges they brought to court. Well, why would you file if you don't have to pay anything? Of course, it begs the point, but check that out. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because now this puts the IRS, there are other court cases, of course, many court cases dealing with the IRS, but at this point it puts the shoe, IRS on the defensive and brings up the potential, the possibility that one day, possibly sooner than later, the IRS agents themselves will be in a courtroom on the defense stand for being extortionists. In other words, extortion is the illegal forcing of taking money from people. Either, you know, you usually think about a con man or somebody with a gun or whatever, but the IRS has been extorting money from individuals for a very long time, and based on no law at all, and this court case proved that, the IRS on the witness stand unable to produce the law that requires you to file and pay income tax on labor. Now, income is a very, it's a legal issue, and so you have to study this to understand what the true meaning of this is. But for the majority of people, say, that work for a company, that receive wages in trade for your labor, you are not gaining anything because you are trading your time, effort, talents, or whatever for wages. And that is not a gain. It's a trade even up. And so that is one of the criteria that would be used to say, and so all of these corporations who are withholding money from individuals, it's just a way of having individuals pay for the taxes that the corporations are not paying. Isn't that an interesting sweetheart deal? But anyway, more on that, and of course, Ed Brown case too. As I said, the reason I'm bringing this up on this show is because of the lack of public awareness due to the media blackout. Which brings up the next topic. How is the country supposed to work? And a lot of people would say, well, if you don't pay taxes, how could the government operate and how could we do all of these things? That, first of all, the government is doing far more than it ever was intended to do. The government was never intended to do things like federal road projects. These were all meant to be in the hands of the states. And that is very clear. So the federal government has just outgrown its bounds. And so the question is, how would science, for example, operate? And it's very interesting because the Constitution itself specifically addresses science. And it's a very general statement, but it says that the government is obligated by virtue of the fact that science is beneficial to the general good of the public, whether it's medicine, whether it's physics, chemistry, biology, and of course at that time Thomas Jefferson was a great scientist himself, and so a lot of the politicians at that time were very well educated and they understood the importance of science. But what has happened today is science has become a monopoly for the people who work for government-funded science. And so how would science actually work in a system in which there is no government funding of science? And that is an interesting point. You would not have all of the scientists sitting around collecting a paycheck saying the same thing year after year because they get a paycheck. And it's kind of like a lot of systems. Let's take NASA. It's much easier for NASA not to do anything because of the chance of failure. If they fail, there's always the chance that people will say, well, you're failing, so therefore we're not going to fund you anymore. So the easiest thing to do is find some long-term program that will go for the next 20 years and then not produce any results, because results could mean failure. That's what's going on in the science world. So this presidential directive to go to the moon and then Mars by the year 2025 or whatever it is exactly that. NASA doesn't have to do a thing for its paycheck. And you can have scientists, space scientists, walking around year after year saying the same old garbage, wearing the same old suit that they probably bought after the day after they got their PhD 20 years ago, and not doing anything. That's government-funded science today. How could it be operated? Typically through private funding, because good science has value. And where there's value, there are investors, and there are investors that understand that value and that the end value, the end product, is something that is worth investing in. So it's a cycle, whereas just as with other branches of the government, if there's no value in what's being produced, there's no measurement. The scientists themselves set the criteria, and it gets looser and looser over time. The goals, the objectives become more abstract, and the public becomes farther and much more removed from science. As I said, the top story on CNN this week, for a week and a half running, a giant squid washes up on the shore. How could that possibly be the top story on a major news media like CNN for a week and a half? Absolutely impossible, unless you're in the United States, with the tremendous amount of money that's being funded into the scientific world. Why do you think year after year you can still hear about the dirty snowball comet model when it's absolutely patently false? You get up close to a comet nucleus, there's no ice, there's no snow, it's hot, it's a big hot, in most cases, black rock. There's no water coming off the nucleus to create the tail, but don't tell that to a NASA scientist, because he's getting a paycheck to say otherwise. In fact, in this article that I just quoted from spaceweather.com, it's spaceweather.com, where I told you to go look for the Comet Linear VZ13 2006 maps. They, in that same article, they state, oh, and this material is coming off the comet nucleus. It's like a nursery rhyme. They keep repeating it over and over again, and it is patently false. Any idiot can look at the data that has come back from Comet Tempel 1, from Jacobini-Zinner, from Comet Halley's, from Comet Borelli, all of the other Comet Vild 2, all of the comets that have had probes right next to them, not a drop of water or ice has been seen on any of them. There was an extremely faint water patch on Tempel 1, but it wasn't sublimating, it wasn't creating a comet tail. There was no water coming off the nucleus at all. Yet trained PhD scientists who get a paycheck every week from NASA will tell you that it's a dirty snowball. So the point being, now here's another story that fits right in. This past week, the Hurricane Center, the National Hurricane Prediction Center, had a big uproar with its staff. 70% of the staff signed a petition to relieve them of their new leader. The reason, because he said publicly, he went to Congress and he said, one of our satellites has failed, It's one of the tools we need to make predictions of hurricane paths, and we need to have it replaced. What the staff wanted him to do was to keep his mouth shut, because they knew, number one, Congress wasn't going to fund a new satellite replacement, and even if they did, it wouldn't be up in the sky for years. And number two, the public might get wind of this, and they would lose credibility. Well, what would happen if they would lose credibility? They might not get funded. So they would rather tell the leader, their fearless leader, to shut up and don't say anything about the fact that one of their tools is missing and not tell you, the public. Isn't that an amazing twist of events? For scientists, they didn't want the public to know that one of their tools was missing that might help them predict, but by the way, their predictions are based on totally false theoretical work anyway, because hurricanes are not, I've read the list of factors that they use to predict hurricanes and hurricane paths, not a single one of them have anything to do with hurricane formation or hurricane direction or path prediction. Hurricanes are powered from electrical conditions, driven from electrical currents from the ionosphere to the top of the storm systems. That's what drives a hurricane. Not a single factor in the NOAA weather prediction computer models has anything to do with the reality of the cause, the true cause of hurricanes or typhoons. So how in the world could they possibly predict them? But don't tell that to these people. All they're looking for is a paycheck. And that's what, if you look through, if you read between the lines of this request to have the leader, the fearless leader of the National Hurricane Prediction Center, relieved of his position, it's all based on the fact that they want a paycheck and they don't want anybody to think they are incompetent or are missing some of their tools that they would need to make a clear prediction of where hurricanes go. That's exactly the point I'm making. Government-funded science. Now, if this were a private corporation, they would go to their investors and say, if there were competition, see, most of these agencies, there's no competition, so they can sit there and not do their job and still get paid. If this were a competitive market with two or three or four companies vying for the hurricane prediction market, then they would have to go to their fearless leader and say, yes, go out there and tell our sponsors that we're missing this satellite and we can't be competitive without it. But there's no competition, so the end result is the free paycheck from the government could be in jeopardy if someone found out they didn't have their precious satellite. Is that twisted or what? On to another topic here. By the way, where are all the Atlantic hurricanes? I recall this spring hearing the National Hurricane Prediction Center spouting off that this was going to be a bumper crop year of hurricanes. Well, where are they, folks? I don't know. On to a bit of a scientific topic. We are heading into the month of August, which is the peak aurora season. And I always encourage people are looking for a place to go, a family outing, camping, whatever. And the aurora borealis, the northern lights, will be out soon in their full glory. Try and go as far north as you can, up to the Canadian border or into Canada, and you will see northern lights if you go up there for a number of days. And another thing you can do is, if you have a little bit of flexibility in the timing of your trip, keep an eye out on spaceweather.com is a good site. Other sites that deal with auroras, there's a site in Alaska where they do a lot of aurora borealis research. They will give you predictions of when we will see major aurora conditions. Now, if you happen to be down in the very southern tip of South America, you could possibly see them also, because they do exist down in that region. But the best place to see them. And the reason for this is because the Earth's magnetic north pole, the magnetic north pole, is somewhat near us, closer to us than the actual celestial north pole, which is what we always consider that big candy cane pole up at the top of the Earth there. But the magnetic north pole of Earth is somewhat down towards us in the north, towards the North American continent. Excuse me. So, at any rate, just keep posted, watch the postings on the internet, and if you don't have flexibility in your schedule, get as far north as you can, get away from city lights, and get out there and watch the Aurora Borealis, because it's just an amazing light show. Right now would be a great time. As we head into August, early August, we'll have... that's typically a very good time. But if there's a full moon, of course, that's going to block out a lot of your visibility of the Aurora Borealis. And I believe that's on August 12th. But at any rate, the other thing you can do is plan to go a little bit later in August. And I want to give a relay an experience that I personally had seeing Aurora Borealis. One night I was up on the Canadian border, and we were out near a lake, and the waves were crashing in, but it was a very beautiful, clear night, extremely clear. The dew had fallen, and there was a blazing full moon. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, the Aurora Borealis came out and actually was brighter than the full moon. It was amazing to watch these curtains of light sitting still, and then they'd quick move, and then there were different types of effects. One is where it's like a crown right above you, where the rays are coming out in all directions, going to the horizon or shooting from the horizon up to a point right above your head. And of course, this is due to high energy particles coming into the very upper atmosphere and fluorescing the nitrogen and other molecules that are up in those high altitudes of Earth's atmosphere. Now, also, people have been able to measure sound coming from the auroras, and I've actually experienced that myself also. You can hear it's like a hissing noise, and it's actually due to secondary particles coming down into the lower Earth atmosphere. As the high-energy particles come into the upper atmosphere, they create secondary particles which come down, can reach all the way down to the ground. So at any rate, and remember that auroras actually can occur in the middle of the daytime. I want to review a story that occurred. I was up actually on a deck. We were working on a house far up in the northern Canadian areas, and all of a sudden there was this rush of electrical current coming down all around us through the woods. In the leaves, you could hear the electricity, you could smell the ozone, and it was a perfectly blue sky. Very interesting. But anyway, this is the time of year for Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, and so if you can at all get north if at all possible, certainly do so. Because it's a spectacular event, and it's something that your kids will remember forever. I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.